Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Couple of Nukes. As always, I'm your host, Mr. Whiskey, and today is finally another episode of Civilians versus Nukes, but this is no ordinary civilian. He has sailed the seas, navigated the skies, as well as the earth. So he's been in all three domains we got here on our planet. Captain Russell Roberts, also an author. I actually just finished his book, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. Hopefully, no spoilers. And we're going to talk a little bit about his life, some of the laughs he's shared, and some of the advice he has for us. So, Captain, go ahead and take it away.
Mr. Whiskey, first of all, I want to talk about you for a minute. So,
Oh, thank you.
is whiskey phonetic or is that a beverage choice?
So, I mean, I would drink anything anyone gives me, really. Not the, I'm pretty easy to roofie. Like if someone just hands me a drink, okay. Whiskey's pretty good. It's not my go-to. I actually like more of the fruity stuff, like a Seagram's. I like pina coladas. Like, I don't drink to get wasted and forget the night. I drink because I'm like relaxing. Something nice and relaxing, kind of fruity. So,
There you go. Well, yeah,
what about yourself?
some of us call those sissy drinks, but
Yeah. Trust
when
me,
I'm
I know.
on a cruise ship, I always first thing I get, I sit out in the veranda and ask for a Mai Tai. Give me a Mai Tai. He says, "You want Mai Tai or your Tai?" And then so I get my vacation started with a nice sissy drink. So yeah, so I was wondering about whiskey. You being a Navy man, I didn't know whether it was a phonetic thing for your last name or.
Oh yeah, it's on several levels. It's funny you mentioned sissy drinks. So I went to this bar downtown, and I like to get the fruitier drinks that, and so I'm always being called gay or sissy. And there was this drink, and it was called the Princess Drink. And it was like lychee juice and a little bit of some fruit juice, and it was delicious. But of course, it's so embarrassing. I look at the waiter, I was like, can I get the princess drink?
Well,
Because
you
I
just
already always get, beefed on by the guys for it. But hey, I like to drink what I drink, so
well, I got to a point in life where I figured, well, I fly big jets, and as you mentioned, I've sailed the seas, and well, I figured, tough man. If I like the drink, I don't care what it's called, I'm going to get it. I don't have anything to prove anymore. So there you
It's just
go.
like,
So do we? Should we name? Should we give you a first name? I was thinking, you probably wouldn't want Maker's Mark.
that's funny. So I had to make a face first name for Facebook. It wouldn't let me put Mr. So I put Mark
Oh, more.
for
Okay,
yeah,
so.
it actually was just the first name that came to mind, and I was like, huh, Maker's Mark. I guess it kind of all works out.
So it's M. Mark Whiskey. The
Yeah,
Maker's
essentially,
Mark.
yeah.
We won't tell anybody, but the Maker's Mark. I
Yeah,
was thinking Jameson would be nice, but then you'd be stuck with a middle name of Irish. So,
yeah. Yeah.
so
Well, I'm half
okay.
Italian, half Irish, so.
There you go. Well,
But
that might
mostly
not be bad either.
Italian, mostly Italian. You don't really see it on the show, but in real life, I'm always like, the hands are everywhere.
The hands are everywhere. There you go. Well, good. Well, we've got something going for a new moniker for you. M&M whiskey, Jameson.
Eminem whiskey, I like that. It's funny because I'm dropping my new rap video soon, so that's kind of funny. Kind of not Eminem, not Eminem, Eminem, but Eminem.
Yeah, and so you've got a rap video coming on. And did I
Oh
hear
yeah,
you say that you had already written 9 books?
yes, sir. I've written 9 books. The first six I wrote when I was 14, and so
Wow.
I'm actually rewriting that series because 14-year-old me and me now have totally. My writing skills are better, at least I like to think so.
One would
And
hope.
I've got a couple more books coming out this year. My first nonfiction book coming out this year about suicide and identity and military and civilian life. So
Yeah,
be on
hopefully
the
we'll
lookout
get
for
to.
that. That's going to be pretty epic. And
Yeah,
I'm glad I read
hopefully.
your book because now I have a little more experience with. I don't normally read nonfiction, so think your book and then Vietnam Combat. That episode on my show, I read Robin Bartlett's book. So. Podcasting
There
has
you go.
gotten me into the world of nonfiction books, and they're pretty exciting. They're actually a lot more exciting. Your book was the passion for airplanes. I mean, wow. I've never experienced someone who loved planes so much. I really haven't. I had a buddy in high school who he could tell what a plane was just by hearing the engine noise, and you reminded me of that, and
There
then
you
some.
go. There you go. Exactly. I can do that too. And you look up I look up in the sky, I can generally tell whether it's a Boeing or an Airbus up there, you know, if it's visible at all. But yeah, that's it's just been with me, just part of my DNA. It seems like I was incarnated to be around airplanes in this life, you know, just and I was lucky enough. Some people suggest that because my father was a pilot, that there was nepotism involved. That it was because of him that I got into airplanes, and that could very well be true. But it seems to me that I got into airplanes because as I came into this life, I chose a family that would fulfill my mission. That's the way it feels to me. So, yeah, it's been a as long as I can remember. Well, I guess in the book you read, my first memory of being on Earth here was doing a loop in an Aranka Champ. I was first memory I have being on Earth was upside down in an airplane. So there you go.
So, Roberts, why don't you announce your book for us, for everyone? It's going to be in the description below for the podcast. It's available on Amazon. And I also heard mention of a sequel, perhaps. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the first book is a memoir of my first 30 years and all the flying that was involved in that. And the next one is the sequel, which will be the airline career, the experiences that I had, and also the people that brought me along in the airline industry, my mentors, my friends, that their stories. So hopefully be out before long. I'm working hard on it.
Yeah, that's great. I kind of because the website I found you on for podcasting kind of gave your whole bio. And so I went into the book expecting to read everything. And so I kind of felt like my first day on prom night. You kind of led me on there, I was expecting so much more. And then, but now having finished the book, I realize it's kind of your origin story, setting you up to how you became a pilot. And there's a lot of things in the book I want to address. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, the ending is phenomenal. The plot twist is just wasn't a, you don't expect a plot twist like that in a nonfiction, so it's great. I'm not going to spoil it, but
Oh, there
it
you go.
really left me. It was emotional. It was just so heart-wrenching a moment for me, and
Wow.
I
Well,
can't imagine for you. One of
thanks
the
for thanks for saying so.
Big surprises was the Jehovah Witnesses. I never expected them to show up in your book, and that route I was just completely thrown off guard.
I never expected them to show up in my life either, and yeah, I'd never heard of them. And then when yeah, it changed our family for sure, and changed the family dynamic, and gave me a whole new well, the thing for me that it did, the witnesses showed up, and as I grew up, it allowed me to question what I'd been taught, and thus the title of the book, "Unlearning to Fly," unlearning a lot of the things that parents and others taught that I took for the unvarnished truth, and then as I began to think for myself, of course, all that changed, giving myself permission to cast off those old learnings.
And it's crazy. The last place you'd expect to find Jehovah Witnesses is in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, where you had nothing but junkyards and miles of just abandoned projects. And like, especially there, they kind of spread their word door to door. I mean, that was crazy to me. I would have expected in Virginia, if anywhere.
Yeah, I mean they're everywhere. I mean, just they evangelize, like the Mormons. Mormons go out and around, and they're everywhere also, and it was. Well, we'll just talk about that for a minute. The witnesses, I think, generally, I found them to be good people, morally forthright. Taught to care for each other, and but it just didn't work for me. Just didn't work.
I mean, that message was really clear in the book, how you felt about having Christmas taken away. You
It was
mentioned
horrible.
multiple times the year you lost Christmas.
Yeah, that was excuse me, that was a yeah, that was a bad deal. When you're 6 years old and have Christmas wrenched from you, it's traumatic.
And that's the thing too. Actually, my buddy, we call him Homewrecker. He's been on the show a couple of times, and he actually Jehovah Witnesses were introduced into his life. And I think the most difficult part about that is when you haven't been one and you're still a kid. Because for him, the biggest thing was losing sports and holidays. He wasn't allowed to
Yeah.
participate in sports. And because his parents were separated, his mom was going to court saying, look, his father is forcing him not to partake in sports, but we aren't Jehovah Witnesses, only his father is. And it became this huge thing. And luckily, once Homewrecker got like 16, it became kind of his choice. They were like, look, it's only a part-time Jehovah's Witness if he wants to participate in sports. But yeah, I thought that was really important, just, how it affects children who are already participating in everything in life and suddenly it's taken away.
Yeah.
Discipline as an adult is a lot easier. It should be. It's not always for some people, obviously, but when it comes to like, hey, now I have to abstain from these certain practices, it's much easier as an adult than a child. And to me, that message in the book was so important, and ladies and gentlemen, don't get us wrong. The book isn't bashing on Jehovah's Witnesses the whole time, but there definitely is an insider view of certain things. And I love really how it changed your father almost for the worse. And that's one of the things I want to talk about if you're comfortable getting into it. What I love the most about your book, just because I've had issues with my father and with regards to his drinking, to giving up on everything in life, the book starts off with your father as your hero. He is the perfect man. And as you grow up, there's more and more criticism and kind of the, you had these glasses on that were filtering your father as this perfect man. And as you grow older, they kind of fade away. As you mature, you learn about stuff and you meet other men. Part of the thing is you didn't until later on in your life, then you started having these other father figures you attached to that you mentioned in the book. And so if you could talk a little bit about that. And one of the things I was disappointed in the book of Mr. Roberts was that after the time skip to when you're an adult, your father and family kind of just fade out of the story. But I think that speaks to real life, how when you reach a certain point in your age where your family, if you have a bad relationship with them, you finally have that freedom from them. And so if you could talk a little more about what happened with your family, because your father does make little cameos near the end of the book, and you're talking to him on the phone. And to me, that was the most important part of the book. That's what I took away the most. And it could be personal bias, but I love the relationships and seeing how your father affected your whole life, from the people you clung to later on in life to how you made your decisions and what you thought about.
Yeah, we do leave our parents, don't we? At some point, around puberty, people generally start to separate from their parents.
Right.
And the book took on a life of its own. And toward the end, yes, I was living my own life. But my dad, as you said, he still, as you put it, cameo appearances right up to the end of the book.
Yeah.
We talk about him and, as we get older, well, I cut my dad a little slack now. My father, when the story was going on, he was younger than my own son is now. And so I do cut him a little slack there because he was still forming himself, in his
Right.
late 20s, 30s. So yeah, he was never able to he never became fully actualized. He died when he was 59 years old from cancer. I mentioned in the book how he wasn't feeling well. Well, he died a couple of years after the story ended.
Oh,
But
wow.
so yeah, he an important part of my life, certainly. And you talked about being lucky enough. I was lucky enough to meet other people that came in
Right.
and acted as important mentors.
And I think the important part of that too is some of your mentors, a lot of these guys that you clung to, weren't the best characters, but to you, because they were more successful than your father, because they had that drive that he kind of gave up on, to you, they were like these amazing people, these celebrities, you call them. You call them, Hollywood celebrities. They're, being an airline captain was like king of the world. You
Yes.
talk about people who just were just regular guys, and I think it really spoke to how our fathers play a role in our lives.
My dad's friends, when the story opens, were primarily airline people. He was a mechanic at
Right.
Capital Airlines, which was one of the predecessors of United. he was learning to fly at Beacon Field in Alexandria, Virginia, and the people that surrounded him were a lot from the airlines, and he gravitated to airline pilots as well because that's what he wanted to do. So all of my parents' friends were airline people, and the story opens with a lot of drinking and smoking and shooting rifles into a fireplace. And for me, this was great. I was surrounded by royalty, and I thought this was what royalty did. You know, these lofty airline pilots, airline captains. But as adults reading this, we see, boy, these people were pretty flawed, just like everybody, you know.
Right. And
But
I actually thought that was hilarious. They were shooting guns right in the house. I was like, wow,
that's right.
That's crazy to think about.
It is. It's nuts. And for me, it was like, oh, life. Yeah, this is just what parents and adults do.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, you know, the way you word it, it's almost like your father invented cruise control. Using, I know you had the Volkswagen, they kind of put stuff together to just keep it going. And I was like, they basically invented cruise control.
He kind of did, didn't he? With the little Volkswagen Bug we had, which was our transportation to Alaska. It was either wide open throttle or nothing. So he devised a throttle that would push against the accelerator. And he said, man, that makes driving a whole lot easier. Wouldn't hold a steady speed, but with the Volkswagen, I don't know whether to have a 30 horsepower engine or something. You know, generally you were wide open in 55 miles an hour. So yeah, he was
it's
pretty
crazy.
clever. He was pretty clever. The kitchen he built on the back of the Bug, you know, that was another
Right.
example of his ingenuity. Yeah, my dad was very smart and ingenious, and
Right.
he was also had an addictive personality. And I mentioned he was either addicted to alcohol or religion, sometimes both at the same time. And I,
Yeah.
in retrospect, I don't know which addiction was worse.
Right. And he was also addicted to starting projects and never finishing them. You know, that was, and for me, I was just as disappointed in him as you were in the, he had so much potential. Like, I recognize that. You recognize that. And, you know, it's like he kind of just always put it to waste. And, you know, even with, you know, when he crashed, I believe it was the Luxcombe, I don't know how to pronounce it, but when the
It's
little airplane you
Luscombe.
had,
Luscombe, yeah.
the little airplane you had, even when that was such a big project, and then he kind of just gave up on it. And I remember you talked about how he just let it sit in the driveway, and there's a whole scene where they're taking it away, and you describe how your father was reacting, the guy who was taking it away was reacting, and how you felt. And to me, it was like, wow, you know, he kind of just let it fade away after you had painted it. All the, you said the color scheme was not the most, your father wasn't the best designer.
No, he certainly didn't have a sense of a good color palette. Let's put it that way. Yeah,
Right.
no, that, the airplane did sit in the driveway for some time, and then it was repossessed. Long story short, the airplane had to be taken apart and put in our driveway. My parents had purchased it on a time payment, contract
Right.
payment, and couldn't afford insurance. So when the airplane was balled up, he just let it sit until it was repossessed. The original owner came and got it.
Right.
And I was heartbroken because I think I was 7 or 8 when the airplane finally was repossessed. And that was my airplane.
Yeah.
It belonged to me. And so I was
Right.
heartbroken when it was leaving.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, in the whole book you have these arguments over finances and stuff, and I won't spoil it, but the ending of the book, I think that's part of what was so shocking, you know, without speaking about it, that's what shocked me the most. Like, these financial hardships could have been avoided, you know, so to speak. And I think also just it was a recurring theme. You know, your parents lost this airport that was doing great. The restaurant was doing great. I mean, you grew up there basically and spent every day there. And, you know, I couldn't wrap my head around why your parents let it get, why they didn't, you know, work on their taxes or whatever it was. And I'm sure there's things that even you and you don't know that went into all of that. But it definitely was something that, you know, just the idea that they had everything going for them and they let it get taken away. And this was a reoccurring theme time and again.
Time and again, and it was the end, the success was always in sight, wasn't it? It was just there, and it
Yeah.
wasn't over the horizon. It was in sight, and then it was boom. They cut it off. They stopped it. They torpedoed themselves. They
Yep.
did something to end it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, my dad could have fulfilled his dream of being an airline pilot.
Yeah. Yeah, and
But
that's
when
what's
the opera,
upsetting.
he wasn't willing to wait for time to unfold.
Yeah.
The airlines weren't ready for him for a while. Nobody was hiring when he thought he was ready to be hired. If he had just waited another 4 years, he would have been hired. My grandmother, when we were in Alaska, he had given up by this time. He had become a
Yeah.
religious zealot. He had given up on his dream of being an airline pilot. And my grandmother from the East Coast sent him an advertisement. I think it was from the Washington Star. Eastern Airlines was advertising in the newspaper for pilots. And they were
Yeah.
willing to hire low-time pilots, maybe even with private licenses, and they were going to train them to get their commercial license. She sent him the ad, and he just, oh, well, it won't happen to me. He never replied, never checked in with Eastern. He could have had a decent career. He would have been
Yeah.
retired before their bankruptcy, and would have changed. That would have changed everything for my family.
Right. And it wasn't just his own failures and giving up that kind of broke his spirit. It was also, we talk about how the Jehovah's Witness introduction into your life really changed things. Now, Roberts, how do I'm sure you're haunted by these huge what ifs. I mean, reading the whole book, I was just like, what if this didn't happen? Especially later on in the book, there's a 5-day delay during a agreement where you almost became the CEO of a brand. You were going to restructure an entire airline organization, and that was one of the most painful moments of the book. And I'm sure you still think about it today. What would be your advice for everyone on these what ifs? You've lived quite a while now, and you've lived so many different lives beyond all of that, and you still managed to accomplish your dream. So what life advice do you have for us?
The primary dream that I had for myself was to be an airline pilot.
Yeah.
And the story about how we almost acquired a small airline is interesting. It just sort of fell into my lap. And I was lucky enough to have, again, people in my life, mentors, we'll call them, who made this opportunity possible. The small airline, 21 airplanes, regional carrier in Virginia, was going bankrupt. And
Yeah.
I was able to meet the people who were running it, the executives. And then I had a group, serendipitously, that I knew. So I was able to put these two together. And we came within a week of owning the airline. And it was fun. It was probably one of the most exciting things I've ever been involved with. And
Right.
I can understand now how business people get excited about what they do, because it's like, oh, if this happens now, if we can just do this now, if he
Right.
says
Always
this,
more
we're
projects.
more projects and also pieces and parts of putting it together to make it happen.
Yeah.
We were going to take this small airline and move it to Dulles International Airport prior to United Airlines building a hub. About the same time, really, we would have wound up being the regional carrier for United Airlines on the East Coast,
Yeah.
which we still to this day, I mean, the people involved, most are gone now, but
Right.
we thought we would have a successful operation, and I still believe it would have been. But what I realized when all of that didn't happen, when the airline didn't come to fruition for us, is that my primary dream was not to run an airline, but to be an airline pilot, which, financially speaking, is probably, it doesn't make much sense, but that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I went
Yeah.
back, and I went back to my original dream, which worked out great.
Right. It's almost like, you always have felt predestined to be a pilot. And it's like you almost got off course, and it's like the hands of the universe. And I believe in God. So I'll say God kind of put you right back on course to be a pilot. He's like, you're not a CEO. But it's still amazing to think about. And I do think it would have been successful because y'all called the failure of the woman who overheard of your, overheard of your deal through some means. All right. And basically what
You
happened is,
read carefully. You got a lot of details that I
yes,
even
sir.
thought
Ba
about that
basically,
part.
they offered $1 million more, and you're like, "There's no way we can offer that." And the biggest thing is, y'all could have closed before this. I believe, your one mentor, he was getting older, and he's like, "Is this something I want to do?"
Yes.
And I understand that, but I just wish he had signed the deal, and then if he wasn't feeling it later on in life, he could have passed it on to someone else, because it's a crazy thing. You could have entirely restructured what the East Coast, airline system is like nowadays.
We
You
were very lucky. The
everything.
man you're talking about is Stanley Ogins, dear friend of mine, and
Yeah.
he and his wife Flo were like extra parents for me. So
Right.
I'm so lucky that they came into my life. But Stanley was a self-made millionaire. He had pushed carts in the garment district when he was 12 years old. His father in New York abandoned the family, leaving Stanley at age 12 the breadwinner for
Wow.
his mother, or his younger brother, and himself. So Stan pushed carts in the garment district for a number of years, and this was during the Depression. He would work for, he worked for his uncle, and he remembered taking a water truck and hooking up to a hydrant that happened to be hooked up to a speakeasy, and they would
Wow.
pump beer into the speakeasy. I mean, this guy had a tremendous, tremendous life. And later, the Navy drafted him for World War II. He wound up being the skipper of a ocean-going tug. And after the war, they kept him over in Asia to run the tug carrying supplies between Sasebo, Japan, and Shanghai. So, I mean, he had a tremendous life, and he became something of a takeover artist. He would buy businesses that were in distress and turn them around and run them for a while and make a profit when he sold them. And that's why he was perfect for the Air Virginia thing. We were
Right.
operating his King Air at the time, and we flew together a lot. He was a private pilot. I grew to love him. I mean, just a wonderful person. So with his talents, my ambition, and also the other kingpin in this operation was a guy named Mort Beyer, who ran
Yeah.
an outfit in Arlington, Virginia, called AVMARC, which was at the time and maybe still is the premier airline consultant business. When Pan American wanted to do an employee stock option program, they came to Mort to put it together. Mort had worked for Pan American in the 1950s. So we had these experts, and Mort put together the Dulles Hub proposal for Air Virginia. And
Right.
I had all these people that you've heard that expression, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. When I was ready, all of these experts appeared, these people, helpers,
Right.
just
And
they
it's
were there.
insane. You were so young. You were just doing your thing. And, but you, even though you were young, I talk about this all the time because it's kind of happened in my life too. You had all these life experiences and tragedies and opportunities thrown at you, where you kind of grew up really fast. And talk about the youngest flight instructor in America. They had to change the rules because of you. That was hilarious. But even you had such a crazy opportunity. I was reading this, and I was like, this is insane. This would never happen nowadays. A teacher was supposed to, I don't remember his name, but he sat there smoking cigarettes in like the closet, and he was like, "Russ, I need you to teach this class. I'm supposed to teach it. I don't know anything about it." And you actually got out of your one class to teach another class as a student, took them to air shows and everything. And I was like, that is something that would never happen nowadays, but that was such a unique opportunity that really helped you grow as a person, and I thought it was amazing.
I wonder if things like that could happen today. Are we just not willing to press the envelope? I mean,
I don't
I
know.
find it hard to believe, because to me it doesn't seem like, well, those were the good old days. It just, it was just opportunity presenting itself, and I wonder if we're just not teaching our young people that they can reach out and take the opportunities. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We actually talked about this I talked about it the other day, but I was with Mike Roth. He used to be a salesman, and he was talking about these how things lined up. And these are things that nowadays are completely obsolete, but at the time, these deals he made are, it's like opportunities that wouldn't exist nowadays. And he, kind of, we had a conversation. He said that sales is still relevant today. It's just a totally different game, but it's the same kind of things. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting that you had to grow up pretty fast. And one of the things that I was kind of let down with, because I was very curious about this aspect of your life, is, once you get to the part of the book where you're kind of like 16, you start thinking about girls, and there was this woman named Swinger who was like the woman for one of your mentors, and you just grabbed her right by the gooch in the kitchen, in the middle of the living room, and you were like, wow, that's what it's like to be a man. And and you try to take this girl out, and then your other mentor takes her out for a private ride to the beach that was you wanted her to tag along with you. So, throughout the book, you have no success with women, unfortunately. And then next
No,
thing you know, there's
for
a time
better or
skip.
worse, for better or worse, I'd
For
get to
better
a
or
certain
worse.
point. Of course, the desire was there, but I don't know if I had gotten
May
strongly
have thrown you off your career, yeah.
yeah, it would have thrown me off course, maybe. I don't know. I was fine the way it worked out, but yeah, at
Yeah.
the time it was pretty frustrating.
Right. And
Yeah, and I'm
the
glad I
reason bringing
didn't
that up.
take, Bob when he grabbed Swinger like that, his wife. It was like, yeah, man, that's what men, oh, that's what airline captains can do. And
Yeah.
I saw that, it was like there were a lot of what really were negative examples, and I didn't emulate them. I didn't
Right.
emulate that part of my exemplar's behavior.
Yeah, you were just thinking to yourself, I'm going to be an airline captain, and there's going to be every flight attendant's going to be hot, and she's going to be all over me. And I guess that's the dream of some young men want to be pilots. But the reason I bring it up is we time skip, and then you mentioned you're like, you said you've been married for 2 years now. I was like, to who? And that part of your life kind of got cut out, and I want to know, is that something I can see in the sequel? Because that's something I was really curious about. You kind of didn't mention who you married. You actually talked more about one of your students who's always she was always happy-go-lucky, and I thought you were about to get divorced and leave your wife for this airline student you had, the one who got lost. You kind of let her fly over the mountains, and there was thunderstorms, and I won't spoil all of that, but. I was waiting for you to find love, and then it was like, it was just you kind of just threw it to the side. And is that because your true love was airline? I remember when you were when broadcasting, you were on radio, you felt like you were betraying your you call it your first love, flying. So was your wife really your third love?
Yes, I was married for quite a while. I
Right.
mentioned in the preface to the book that I didn't talk a lot about my siblings either, and
Yeah.
by extension, I didn't talk about my children, nor did I talk about my wife at the time. I really didn't think that my book, primarily about my love of aviation, it was a love
Right.
story, love of aviation. I didn't think that. Those relationships, A, furthered the plot, even though it is a memoir, every
Right.
good story has a plot line. And I didn't think that, I wasn't sure that my story, telling my story about their life and the Roberts family would have been accurate.
Yeah, it definitely would have been biased, but for me, the thing with your book, I know it's the journey between you and the airline industry, but we as a reader, we get attached to you. We're like we actually read it as if we are you. So, that's why I was just really curious. And it's funny, I did think about that because in the beginning of your book, your siblings are, pretty relevant just because, airplanes weren't they were your passion, but they weren't your life yet. You were a child, and especially you go over to one story where you're youngest sister, kind of was messing in your personal space with your airplanes, and then you kind of pushed her away, and then your dad decided to teach you a lesson. And there's I had a lot of mixed feelings about that. I felt like on some level what he did was it was very demonstrative of what you were doing, but I felt like he kind of took it too far. He definitely took it too far. And I think that was your mother being passive during that. I think that really spoke a lot too. About the way your household was ran. But
Well,
yeah,
again,
later
I
on, your siblings are kind of just mentioned like you had your kid being watched by your sister, and that was it. You know,
yes.
there wasn't a lot of mention of that, and I felt like part of that too was just as you grew up, you know, you grew more distant from your family. Like my sister and I, we were almost like twins, inseparable. We always, you know, we knew exactly what each other was thinking. We did everything together. And after I went off into the military and I did my thing, and she was still in school, you know, it's just. We still love each other. We're still siblings, but you know, you kind of just grow apart. You live your own lives, and so I did feel like
You
that.
do.
You know, you leaving them out for the most part kind of spoke to that. How they were in the beginning, you know, they helped develop you as a child when you all lived together, and then they kind of they're in your life, but they're not, you know, a dominant part of it.
It can be it can be episodic, your relationships with people. Of course, when you're a
Right.
child, you know, it's your siblings. My older sister, she's the first friend I had, you know, she was there. She
Right.
was 2 years old when I arrived, and you know, and it's we grew up. Of course, we grew apart, but now, even though we're separated by geography, we're closer now than we have been in decades. And so, relationships with people, yes, it can be episodic, but these people can then come back into your life later. You know, just because
Right.
somebody leaves the scene doesn't mean they won't be back later. You know, and marriages are like that too. Boy, one of the things that I was taught when I was young is that when you marry for life. This was
Right.
I think maybe the religious teaching, maybe it was something my parents brought in from when they were raised. But that I believe that was a structure, that was structural. And
Right.
when my marriage ended, it was like I had to rebuild the whole building from the foundation up. And now new chapters have evolved that wouldn't have been possible if I had remained in that relationship and stayed married. So even though these things, again, unlearning, I unlearned that, I learned that the end of a marriage is not the end of life. The
Right.
end of a relationship, the end of a relationship with your parents, not the end of life. You know, things keep on unfolding if
Yeah.
we're open to them, especially.
Right. And it's, so I'm assuming, did you and your wife get divorced or did she pass away?
No, we were divorced.
Okay.
Yeah, we were
Yeah.
divorced.
I'm just, so my biggest curiosity, what was how you met her and who she was, because I was like, was she a flight stewardess? Because your life revolved around airports and airlines so much. I wonder if you happened to meet someone somewhere else and how that affected your life. Because now you had to bring this person into your world of aviation, which can be a lot to handle. I mean, when I was reading your book, I loved how passionate I read it. Like, this guy is obsessed with planes. Because growing up, I mean, the way you spoke about things, the book is very well written. Let me congratulate you on that. It is very well written. I mean, it is, you are speaking from the heart, and you spoke in such a way that I almost grew to love planes. And then once you got to all the technical terms, I was like, all right, forget it. You know, you're talking about all the instruments inside, which was still fascinating to learn about, but I was like, all right, this is beyond my level. No, but it's also interesting that at such a young age, I didn't know you could fly airplanes so young.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly, like I said, airplanes were the thread, you know, that just I wrote somewhere,
Right.
somebody wrote it, I don't know. They were the thread that held my life together as I was growing up. And, you know, it hasn't always been a perfect relationship either.
Yeah.
The new book, I've described it, you know, as people say, well, what's the book about? And I could say, oh, it's about my next 30 years of flying airplanes. Kind
Right.
of dull. So what I say
Yeah.
is that millions of people get to ride on airliners, but very few get to ride in the cockpit, you know, past that locked closed door. And the
Yeah.
cockpit is where the action is. And flying for an airline, I've described it as having great sex with an abusive spouse. And
I'm familiar with that.
you And add another thing with the airlines, you can't divorce the spouse. You're stuck with
Yeah.
that spouse forever. If you change airlines in the middle of a career, you start over at the bottom. It's not like if you're I don't know, a physician that moves to another hospital. If you
Right.
an airline pilot, and you get rehired by another airline, you start at the very bottom of the seniority list. And that means not only responsibility, it also means salary starts completely over. So that's something you just
Oh,
can't
wow.
do it. I mean, you when you saddle that horse, you ride it to the end. And so imagine that, being the
Yeah.
spouse of an abusive person, and yet you're having terrific sex at the same time. I
I
mean,
don't even have to imagine it because I read your book. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to know this abuse from the airlines that Russ is talking about, or just flying in general, in his book, he takes a single engine little plane across the whole ocean, and it is not a chapter of the book that will put you to sleep because it's boring. It'll put you to sleep because his exhaustion, it was so relatable. Because Russ, I've driven 8 to 17 hours at a time. You're not even supposed to drive that far after working all day, and so it obviously is not as dangerous as being in an airplane over the middle of the ocean with nowhere to land, but that combating your eyelids as they're
oh.
heavy, you just want to sleep, and then only getting 3 or 4 hours of sleep in very uncomfortable areas. And I won't spoil where you had to sleep, but that experience to me was just reading about it. I was like, I don't want to be a pilot.
Oh.
So that's part of the abusive relationship you're talking about, because you love flying, but there were times. And this was just the beginning of your story. I can imagine in the sequel some of the horror stories of flying you can share with us. But there are times where flying, as much as you loved it, it was an awful experience. You got the short end of the stick.
Yes, and when I'm talking about abuse, I don't want to talk. I'm not talking about actually flying. Yes, there were hard parts, and trying
Okay.
to stay awake over the ocean was difficult.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about is the relationship between airline management and employees, the unions, the strikes, the turmoil, the lousy schedules,
Okay.
the
Would you
fatigue.
say there is toxic leadership in a poor work command climate?
Say that again.
Would you describe it as, because we talk all the time on the show, especially in the military, about two things: toxic leadership, and that's just leaders who, for example, you're talking about the scheduling sucks. And I had leaders in the military where we could have had a better schedule, and they said, "Hey, you don't have it worse than I did. I don't care." Or
Yeah.
they it seems like they're purposefully trying to make the schedule bad, because I'm sure there was times as a pilot you were like, well, flying this and there would make more sense than doing this, that, and that. But you only have so much power. And when I say command climate, just like the interactions between all the pilots and the management, was it kind of different depending where you were, and how did that affect you? And did it kind of deter you from wanting to be a pilot? You talk about, did you want to start over? And the reason you didn't was because of the you didn't want to start over, financially and from the bottom again. It was almost like a chain to you.
Yes, I would say that the abuse was primarily systemic. The airline pilots and the management would hash out contracts, which was always a tumultuous time
Yeah.
when we were developing new contracts, new work rules, etc. But it was just I think the relationships between management and employees made the work environment toxic to a degree. Now, you mentioned that, airline pilots only have so much control, and I guess that's true. But whenever there was a question of safety, if I made decisions, I was never questioned by management. I never got a phone
Okay.
call from upper management about what I had done. Now, in my entire career, I got a handful of, not less than a handful, one or two times management would call to get more information about something that had happened.
Right.
But that was generally personnel related. But I was never questioned on making a command decision, a
Yeah.
decision for safety. That's one thing that the three airline managements that I worked for without ever changing jobs through mergers never questioned about that. So
Okay.
that's a good thing. That's part of the
Yeah.
system that really
They
worked. But
trusted you to do your job.
I trusted every captain on the line to do his job, and being human, sometimes people would get into trouble, and they'd have to take it from there. But fortunately, in my career, everything seemed to work out okay. There was
Yeah.
pressure. There was pressure sometimes. I remember being on Guam one day when we were leaving to go back to Tokyo. We had a tropical storm rolling through, and it was a named tropical storm. And the wind was blowing such that we were right on the edge of having a maximum crosswind. I mean, just within, it
Wow.
was right on, like, I think the max crosswind was 45 knots. We were at 44 knots blowing across a runway.
Right.
It's a tropical storm, and one runway was closed. The nearest Air Force base, Anderson Air Force Base, had closed down, and they had even sent the crash, fire, and rescue people home. So the closest airport that I had available to me that was open was Tokyo, 1,500 nautical miles away. I didn't think
Right.
it prudent to take off in a jet and have the nearest airport be that far away. So I called the dispatchers back in the States. I said, "Hey, we're going to delay until it looks better." They said, "Well, what's wrong? You don't need a takeoff alternate." And they were right as far as the weather. The visibility was good enough. I did not legally need a takeoff alternate. Anyway, they questioned that decision. They said, "Well, made several calls." And they finally said, "Well, they want you to take off and go." I said, "Well, I don't know who they are, but I'm here and they're there, so we're going to wait until it's safe to
Right.
go." I said, I said, "As soon as Saipan opens up that I could land there, that's a safe alternate in a case I lose an engine
Yeah.
on takeoff. I can't return to Guam because, say, a palm tree has blown across the runway. I need another
Right.
airport to go to." So that was it. They were trying to pressure me over the phone, but ultimately it was like, well, we'll leave when I'm ready to leave. That's how it worked out. So that's an example of how captain authority is actually put in place.
Right. And so before we wrap things up here, what I want to give you the opportunity to do is, you mentioned some conflicts and you said, hey, just saying the next 3 years of my life flying airlines is kind of boring. So in anticipation for your next book, can you kind of tease us a little bit? What kind of conflicts and kind of plot situations can we expect for that
Well,
excitement?
stories like that one about the Guam tropical storm, that would be an example
Yeah.
of interpersonal relationships, the good ones, the bad ones. I am going
Right.
to, I'm toying with the idea of having a section, and I'm going to put this in bold, the outliers, the people that maybe don't quite fit in the airline industry, but they're there nonetheless. And you've seen those in the
Right.
Navy. It's like,
Oh yeah. Some odd characters. It's like, how did you get here? Why are you here? And how did this happen with you?
why are you allowed to make these kind of decisions and you're still here?
Yes, that's a bigger one.
And which you've seen many times, I'm
Oh
sure.
yeah.
Yes.
Oh
So
yeah.
that, but I'm going to put that in bold because those people represent less than 1%. When you're talking about pilots, it would be
Oh yeah.
less than 1% of the total. So we
But
have to
they're the
make,
ones you remember though.
they're the ones we remember. And somebody, who was it, wrote that. Oh, I know who it was. It was the guy who wrote Res Life, REZ, Res Life, about living up in, I think he was an Ojibwe Indian, but he wrote that the exceptions illustrate the rule better than writing about normal day-to-day, everyday people. It's the exceptions that really laser beam what we're talking about. The counterpoint to the good things. So I don't know how I can write it without putting those outliers in. So I think that'll be included. I'm going to write about the my mentors, the people that taught me to operate in the airline environment, the good people. And I'm also going to do what you talked about, or you mentioned that in the first book. You felt like you were flying along, which is great. What I'm going to try to do is put you into the first officer's seat of an international flight between Holland and India, for example,
Okay.
and try to make it to feel somebody who's never flown before. Somehow they appear in the seat. Now we're going to hopefully have
Fly
you
together.
feel. have you feel it, what it's like, and educate you gently on the things maybe you don't under. I don't want to get too far into the woods on the technical
Yeah.
stuff because you're not the first guy to mention it was kind of like left you kind of like, what do I do with this? Let's move to the next chapter. So
Yeah.
I've got to kind of go easy on that, but
Yeah, and it depends. Like, I love some of the stuff, like, you had a compass malfunction and you took it out and you filled it with jet fuel. And I was like, this is like, having been an operator and getting a degree in nuclear engineering technology, like, I love that mechanical stuff. So I think it's cool. But I was like, if I was a young woman or man, reading this, and I was like, I don't know, you're talking about all these needles and gauges. But I think it was important too because it shows how much knowledge you have to have as a pilot. People think you just go up there, you hit autopilot, and you're just sitting there getting paid big bucks. And they need to understand. And that's why I also loved, you run through all these what if scenarios. When you're doing your pre-flight check and you're sitting down, you're just like you said in that Guam story. You're like, what if I need to land, and I can't? So I think those are so
Right.
important. And we've seen a lot of airline incidents where, obviously people didn't think through ahead of time. And so, Russ, have you ever had to make an emergency landing or any huge bad scenarios that we can look forward to reading about?
There'll be a couple of
Okay.
stories like that. Yeah. There'll be
Yeah.
some, there'll be
Awesome.
some high adventure in there, and then also the
Awesome.
Yeah. Now
Yeah,
your
I'm
deal,
excited for that.
you were on the ship. Were you on a Nimitz class?
On a submarine for a little bit, but then I spent most of my
Oh.
time on an aircraft carrier, and that actually
Yeah.
ties into I was going to ask you. So I saw in your bio that you had some sailing days, and you mentioned that. Is that going to be a separate book in your book, or is that just a story, a chapter of your life that is just kind of there?
Yeah, for right now, it's just kind of there.
Okay,
I did a
I'm waiting for
lecture.
that.
I did a lecture, a slideshow really around the country of our trip over the Canadian Arctic on the Northwest Passage. We sailed in the wake of Roald Amundsen's first successful Northwest Passage. So I did
Wow.
that, and putting that story together, I've told that story. So I'm not
Right.
sure that that sailing will be something I get time to address. I'm not the youngest guy anymore. I'm not sure I'll
Right.
have time to write every chapter, but we'll address that. We'll
Okay.
address the airline for sure is what I meant, and there's a couple other books I have in mind, and I don't know if we'll do the sailing thing or not.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I at least looking forward to the aviation, and do you have a name for it? 'Cause I'm thinking it's going to be relearning to fly, something like that.
The name right now is called Working Title Book Two, so
Nice. Nice.
we'll release the name closer to when the project's done,
Yeah.
and we see what we actually have there.
Yeah. You're
Yeah.
welcome to use relearning to fly. You unlearn to fly and
Oh.
oh, now I'm a pilot and I gotta relearn to fly, but
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
thank you for
And
the suggestion.
Russ, I
Yeah.
gotta see, looking on camera here, you're not wearing glasses, but that was a big conflict in the first book you wrote. So what happened with that? Are you just not wearing them or?
Bunch of things happened over the years, as we learned in the first book. Airline pilots, 1960s,
Right.
50s, 60s had to be steely-jawed, and
Yeah.
Chuck Yeager writes about being able to see over the horizon and through mountains. That's the
Yeah.
kind, it's an exaggeration, of course, but
Yeah, of course.
that's what was expected. You had to be physically perfect. You had to have razor-sharp eyes. Well, I didn't get the memo on that until later, and when I was 12 or so, I needed
Yeah.
glasses and wore glasses. And then one day I learned that, guess what? You're not going to get hired with
Yeah.
glasses. I crushed my entire dream. Well,
Oh yeah.
obviously, I did wear glasses. I did become an airline pilot. Later, they developed something called LASIK, which was very
Okay.
nice. Yeah,
Yeah.
so got rid of the glasses eventually.
Yeah, and you mentioned it throughout the book. I mean, it's mentioned a lot. People were like encouraging you, and then you would end it with, but they don't realize. That do they not know airline pilots can't wear glasses, or you kind of felt like people were just humoring you at some point. But I think it's great that they encouraged you. I think it's great that you didn't give up despite your glasses, because eventually that changed. And so my message to everyone It is like you mentioned, waiting for the right time. Your father kind of gave up too early. You could have given up at any point and been like, and if you had given up at a young age because of the glasses, you wouldn't have had the experience to then get hired when you could have glasses. And so I just want to emphasize that point to everyone,
Super point. Very good point. You're absolutely right. I mean, I did have the opportunity to, I got into radio broadcasting in high school and did that for a number of years, full time and part time. And I could have done that. I know I could have been successful in furthering that career. So I did have something else I could do, but boy, I'm sure glad I kept returning to my primary dream. Don't give up on your dreams because sometimes, while they might be dormant, you never know when they might come to fruition. My dad, he gave up. He gave up on his dreams. Oh, whether that was a product of his addictions or what, I don't know. Maybe the way he was raised, his father was an alcoholic as well. So, who knows? Children of alcoholics have different ways of looking at things. Yeah, you mentioned your tough background.
And that's why, you mentioned people say, well, hey, you want to be an airline pilot and fly because that's what your dad was into. But a lot of times when people have parents that, or not the best relationship with their parents. Like, for example, I don't want to be anything like my dad, and that could translate over to career. You could have taken your dad as an example of what pilots were, but luckily you looked at pilots in television, in magazines and all this, and you were like, that's what a real pilot is. And my dad hasn't gotten there yet. He gave up on that, but I want to, do it. And the end of the book kind of hurts too, because it's almost like your dad was too ashamed of himself to be proud of you. It is kind of how it came off, because instead of saying, congratulations, son, I'm so glad that you've become a true pilot, he kind of just says, I didn't think you were going to make it. And it's kind of like a joke, but I think on some levels it wasn't a joke. I mean, you address it a little bit in the book. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, it's almost like he was too ashamed of himself, embarrassed to admit pride in you, which, as a father, admitting pride in your son is nothing to be ashamed about, no matter whether you're a failure or a success. When your children, if they surpass you, you should be proud of them. And how do you feel about that, Russ?
I think he was happy, and I think he was proud. He came from a generation of men that didn't emote. We kind of keep our emotions kind of hidden. So there was that, and I think you're right. I think he may have realized that he could have fulfilled his dream as well. It is possible because I don't think he was being mean when he said that he never thought that I would make it. I think because of things like my glasses. I think of things like the Roberts men. My
Like a
dad and
family
his
curse.
father never made their dreams, never hit the mark. And he, I don't know, he probably felt that Roberts men just don't make it. It's not something that's realistic, I mentioned the book several times. One of his favorite expressions was speaking to me was, "You're heading for a fall." Everything I did, he was always expecting me to fall. It was insulting, first of all. It was meant to be, but it was also, watch out for your expectations because they're going to be dashed. Don't
He was
dream. If
kind
you don't
of
have a dream, it's going to be dashed.
He was like programming a generational curse into you almost.
Yes, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right about that. Yeah. So it's a lot to it, We you can't really jump into somebody's head to figure out what's going on. I don't know who the Michael Pollan wrote a book recently, in the last 5 years or so, about he said if we were able to jump into somebody else's head, we'd wig out because it would be like being on LSD. It'd be such a wild place to be. We couldn't
A whole
stand it.
different world.
Completely different universe. Yeah. So I really can't, I can guess at what my dad was thinking, what was going on, but really get into his head. Not going to happen.
And one of the things I'll address here real quick is Your father became a Jehovah's Witness, very devoted to it. And he always said you were too smart because you would ask questions. You would have biblical proof stating otherwise. And I love that he almost expressed this mindset of just like blindly follow people. And
Yes.
I don't know if he was telling you that to keep you safe or if he was afraid of, because you were smart and because you had that leadership in you, he was afraid of what that could be. I mean, because it was mentioned a few times in the book, both in your childhood and later on in life. He says you're too smart for your own good. Stop
What
asking
he said
questions,
was
stop trying to figure stuff
the
out.
quote is one of his other favorite expressions. You know, one was "you're heading for a fall." The other one
Right.
is "you're too smart to learn."
Yeah.
That was
Yeah.
it. That's what he would say. You know, you just don't. You're not accepting you're not accepting the party line here. You're not accepting what we're teaching you. You know, yeah. And I just read this morning in a great book Harari wrote it. Yigal Harari. It's called Homo Deus. It's his sequel to Sapiens, and he was writing about the di difference between religion and spirituality. Religion is the party line. Religion is the set of laws, the set of rules to live by. Where
Okay.
spirituality, he said, is always an individual path. You
Yeah.
know, and that's the hard one. He said Martin Luther followed his spiritual path.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with what's wrong with the Catholic Church? How is it that this was an example in the book? How
Right.
is it that the Pope can forgive your sins by the payment of money?
Right.
These kind of things. And he Martin Luther came up with the 95 things that he was saying. This is what's wrong with the Catholic Church.
Right.
Nailed it on the wall of the church. And but after a while, Protestantism, the became a set of rules again. It be from
Yeah.
going to a
Yeah.
spiritual path, it became a
Ironic.
it became a religious set of edicts, etc. And that's that same thing that by extension, that's we do that on a personal level too.
Right.
You know, I had my own path, and my father had all these. He had it all worked out for me. Here's what's going to happen. You're too smart to learn. You're heading for a fall. Here are the rules. Here.
Right.
You know, so give up on, don't expect your individual dreams to ever go anywhere. I don't know,
Yeah, and
what do you think about that? Does that sound like it rings true?
so it's interesting because I had an episode that by the time this episode come out, it'll already be out. So check it out. It was with Mr. Brian Strubar, and he's written a bunch of books, and one of them was called Escaping Religion Prison, and he and I brought it up and talked about it. And we talked about a couple of things. One, how, people are so quick to judge a religion based on one individual they meet. And what I said is this, I put it this way. I said, let's say Elon Musk and SpaceX, that was the example I used. If you met some employee who worked at SpaceX and they were stupid or rude, you wouldn't think, well, that must be how Elon Musk is because his employee is. But when people meet a Christian who is a sinner or arrogant and not biblically versed, they immediately think that's what God and the whole religion is. And Mr. Strubar grew up where he couldn't ride a bicycle on certain days. He had to have like the rims on his tires inside out because otherwise it was idolatry, right? So, he talks
Yeah.
about stuff like that or facing a certain way. But you could do stuff in the house on a Sabbath day or in the backyard because no one could see you. They said, if the neighbors can't see you, God can't see you. So we talk about the reason I bring it up is because, your father always said you were too smart to learn to just blindly follow. I said, when it comes to these religions, religious prisons, we almost call them. I said, and when it comes to judging other religions, I do not want to hear judgment from anyone who has never read the Bible. Because if you haven't read the Bible, how are you going to judge a religion? Because the people aren't representations of the religion, right? People take their own version of anything, right, in life. We all process information differently. And so unless, how can you judge God? The only way you can judge God is by reading the Bible, right? Because that's his word. That's what he said. That's who he is. And, the people who act on his behalf, a lot of times, a lot of them aren't acting on his behalf. And so that's just a perspective I want to bring up again. because your father said you're too smart to learn. No, you actually read, the scripture or thought about things. And so I don't think you were too smart to learn. I think you were too smart to be just blindly led on. And I'm not saying Jehovah's Witnesses are wrong. They had their interpretation of the Bible. But I think, there's certain things you can question, which you bring up in the book, which I think are some great points. And so, yeah, I like what you said about there's, the individual religious journey, and then there's the groups, the laws, and all that. And I'm a big advocate for everyone having their own individual journey with God, because I did grow up Catholic. There's a lot of Catholic traditions I don't agree with because they're man-made. They're made by humans, and they're not biblical. And so my journey of God has, I've grown so close with God because I have taken away, I've stepped out of the community. And I'm saying community is important. Don't get me wrong. Jesus said, wherever two or more of you are gathered, I will be there also. It's important to have community. That's what religion and humans are meant to be. But everyone should take a step back and kind of go on that solo journey with God too. Even if you're an atheist, I think it's important for you to read the Bible. One, it's a good book full of wisdom. But two, it'll really educate you. And I'm not saying atheists are uneducated, but I'm saying when you encounter people who are acting or speak on behalf of a religion, never ever take those people as representatives of that, because I think religion is an individual journey. And I think you should, kind of have that representation of it through yourself and your studies and what you find. And what's your opinion on that, Russ, especially having encountered the Jehovah's Witnesses and how that ties in?
Yeah, I would say, going back to what we mentioned earlier, religion is the set of rules and the dictum, and a spiritual journey is something else. So that's your own path, your own
Right.
questioning, your own truth that's revealed to you. Now, I love what Joseph Campbell wrote. Are you familiar with Joseph Campbell, a late professor of methodology and comparative religion at Sarah Lawrence College?
Probably not, sir. I kind of recognize the name, and I may be familiar
Yeah.
with his work, but I can't give you anything off the top of
Years
my
ago, I
head.
think the late 80s, he and Bill Moyers did a set of documentaries on mythology, and
Okay.
it's a wonderful thing. One thing he talked about, Joe Campbell, was the masks of God. How can we describe the infinite?
Right.
How can we put that into words? How can we even put the infinite into thought? Well, humans have done that, according to Joseph Campbell, by developing masks. The
Okay.
thing that we describe, it's how human beings describe the infinite. And so there are a thousand different there are an
Right.
unlimited number of ways we can, as humans, can to make this mask say, this is an image of God. Well, this is an image of
Right.
God. And you talk about the Bible, there's also the other texts to read
Right.
and study, the Upanishads from India, the
Yeah.
Quran, the writings of histories that come down to us from the Mesoamericans. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
so many stories that are written to describe the God, to describe the Creator,
Right.
the infinite. Oh yeah.
Right.
So that's the way down.
Yes.
That's one thing the Jehovah's Witness experience gave me was, I'm not. Their major tenet was that they're going to live. They're going to survive the last battle, and then the
Right.
faithful Jehovah's Witnesses are going to live forever, ever as human beings on Earth. And I
Only a few
started.
of them. From what I read in your book, there was a select group of saved people that was only like 144,000 or something like that.
Yeah, they're actually going to go to heaven, right?
Right.
But human beings, there were an unlimited number of humans, as long as they were Jehovah's Witnesses, who were going to
Okay.
survive and live on Earth forever in a human body. And I had trouble with that one starting out at 7 years old. What
Right.
about our teeth? Are we going to regrow our teeth?
Huh.
Our ears
Yeah.
and nose keep growing. Are we going to look like elephants? I mean, I had a little problem with
Yeah.
that. That's the first question that I remember asking. Hey, is this really true? So it
Yeah.
allowed me, it gave me permission to start asking questions. And so that's why
Right.
I, over the decades, I've read the Upanishads. I've, one of the joys of going to India was be able to go and see their representations of their mythology. So it's opened me up, and
Right.
it's opened up a universe of spirituality that I don't think would have been available to me had I bought into
Right.
the singular teachings,
And you know what was so interesting to me was Jehovah's Witnesses believe in this Armageddon day that's coming and all of that. And you know, I'm religious and I believe in rapture and the second coming of Jesus Christ, but they kind of drop everything to just they just devote their lives to preparing for that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't prepare for the rapture spiritually, but I think giving up on our dreams, our jobs, our families, I don't think that's the way to go about it, you know. And that's kind of, and you kind of mentioned it in your book a couple of times that your dad was just preparing for this doomsday that was going to eventually come, you know, and he kind of gave up on everything else for that. And I think it's important to prepare for the future, but I think also just no longer living life in preparation for it is not the way to go.
it would seem not. I mean, the 1914 was the first prediction of
Yeah.
Armageddon by the Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, that didn't happen, so they
110 years ago now.
rejiggered the formula, and I don't know. I haven't been associated with the
Right.
Jehovah's Witnesses since I was, essentially 12 years old. So I don't know what
Yeah.
the current teaching is, or
I don't know.
what the amendments, but. All religions, it's be it's I think the one fundamental thing we have to think about is not mistaking the map for the territory. We
Right.
take a religious teaching and we're looking at it. Again, it's a kind of like the mask of God. It's a description. We're
Right.
looking at the map, and when we think, oh, this map is the actual reality of the situation, we're not looking out the window and seeing the world that the map represents. And I think a lot of
Right.
that goes with if we lock into the religious teachings,
Oh yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as we approach the runway here, just to put it for you to humor you, Russ, you know, as we usually we're on a submarine. I guess this episode we're in an airplane. But yeah, so as we approach the runway here with a safe landing, hopefully, you know, is there anything, Captain Roberts, that you'd like to end us with? Any advice or any takeaways or anything you'd like to say, or you think we covered it all?
I want to talk about you a little bit, and I
Okay,
didn't.
yeah,
I
let's. Oh,
assumed
okay.
that you were always on the carrier, but the submarine thing—that's I grew
Oh
up
yeah, thank
with
you.
Run Silent, Run Deep, and all the
Yeah.
submarine pictures. I just in my I love the story of submarines,
Thanks.
and I really admire the some of the smartest people in the
Oh yeah.
that join the military. They don't take
Everyone keeps
people.
telling me I gotta watch Das Boot. I haven't watched it yet. Everyone keeps
What?
telling me they're like, you have to watch that you have to watch that. So
Which one is that?
it's Das Boot. I believe it's about a
Oh
German
yeah,
sub
Das
in the
Boot. Yeah, I
war.
know. Hey, you have to see that. That's a good one.
Yeah.
There are some really terrific submarine movies, and they're all so dramatic. And golly, you think about it. You're under the water with all that pressure and the isolation. And oh man, if you don't write a book about your experience and maybe a novel,
Yeah.
there you
You
go.
know, I almost subbed Foley and one because it got you know, I could be stationed in Hawaii, which I always wanted, you know, or right here in Kings Bay, Georgia. But the thing is, the reason I chose aircraft carrier was just because the sunlight, the workload, the community, it's just the lifestyle I prefer. It's funny, my old roommate, we call him King on this show. This is hilarious. He could not swim. He didn't know how to swim, right? Most Navy men don't and women don't know how to swim, believe it or
Right.
not. It's ironically cruel.
Captain Cook didn't know how to swim, and that's why he was killed by the Hawaiians. If he'd just been able to swim out to the boat, all the guys were out there, "Come on, Captain, swim on." "I don't know how to swim."
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's ironic. That's
So the
how it
tradition
always seems to
continues in the
go.
modern Navy too. Most people don't know how to swim, huh?
Well, it's funny, a lot of aviation people are scared of heights. You know, but they're like, because I'm
Absolutely.
in an enclosed vessel, I'm not scared of heights. I've heard
Yeah.
that a lot too. I don't know if I assume you're not afraid of heights. I'd have to assume that.
My when I lean over a high building and look straight down, my knees get weak.
That's so funny. Yeah.
So there is some notice at least of heights, but in the airplane it's a completely different experience. And
Oh
why
yeah.
that
Yeah.
is, I don't know. Somebody needs
I
to
don't know.
explain that.
That's how my dad was, though. He was like, he didn't really like heights, but if you put him in a helicopter or a Ferris wheel, if he was enclosed in, he was fine. But bringing it
Yeah.
back to my roommate, he didn't know how to swim. So he purposely chose a submarine. He goes, aircraft carrier gets attacked or something, I might end up in the water. I don't want to drown. The submarine, anything happens to that,
Boom,
I'm
you're
already
down.
dead. And he goes, and if it starts flooding, he goes, I've got a thing of strawberry bleach I carry on me at all times. So I'm not gonna drown. I'm gonna have that strawberry flavored bleach, my favorite flavor. That was his plan. That was his emergency survival plan, was he was gonna get like strawberry flavoring and added a bleach and just
I was
get
so
himself before the water does.
Well, the carrier, you're out there, you got plenty of sunshine and all that. There's just that little thing of launching those airplanes right over your head round the
Oh yeah.
clock. It must have been a little wearing on you.
Oh, I remember we got there was a jet that got onto our ship, and I remember they had it tied down there, and no one was around. And me and the Sandman, my former unofficial co-host, we were just I was like, dude, let's just sneak in. Like no one's, but we didn't because it would be so much trouble. But I was like, I want to go sit inside this jet. That's so cool, and it's dangerous too. We've seen videos of where the cable, they got the giant cables on the ship snap, and it just goes back and cuts people in half, breaks their legs and everything. Like respect for the people who work on the aviation deck. It's not an easy job. It's dangerous, and
Do they still call those guys Skittles?
I don't know. I haven't heard that term before. That's pretty funny.
All the different
I'll have to
colors,
ask my aviation buddies.
all the different colors of the guys out on the deck. Yeah, what an
I know what you're
operation.
talking about now. Okay. Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned that when they started doing aviation testing and flying on my ship, because we were in a shipyard for a while. I was in the galley with Homewrecker and all the aviation people, there was people in purple, people in green and yellow. I was like, what the hell is this? So you used to call Skittles. That makes so much sense. At first, I was like, Skittles, what does that have to do? Yeah, they all wear different colors up there, but that's safe. That's smart,
Yeah, I was lucky to be able to go out on the Teddy Roosevelt theater,
Really?
Roosevelt a couple of times on fam trips. And, they did some launches and some traps right there and some supersonic flybys. And
That's
yeah, it
awesome.
was great. I really regret not having a Navy career. I would have loved to be a naval aviator and
Well, you say
Or a
that.
submarine guy, both of those things. So, you got to serve on both carriers and submarines. So, can you name which ship you were on?
Yeah, I was on the CVN 73 USS George Washington. So my experience was very unique because that ship is 7 years behind schedule because of mass suicides and COVID. Basically, the shipyard process wasn't supposed to take that long. But when COVID hit, the military had, I mean, it was its own system of dealing with COVID because long after masks were removed for the civilian war, they weren't mandatory. They still were mandatory for the military. Which makes sense. You always want the military to be ready, right? Civilians, like, all right, if they're not feeling as good with whatever, if another country attacks, but you want your military at the top of their game. But I hated that. I hated wearing a mask. I wouldn't have worn one if I wasn't forced to. And it made it awful. It made everyone sleepy and agitated. And it's insane to think that there was children who grew up and thought that was normal, that humans had always just worn masks. It really did. And we just talked, and I just launched with Stephen Barra a new show called Generational Bridge Builders, and we discuss how COVID kind of changed everyone's life, regardless of whether you think it was a conspiracy or real or how you personally feel about it. It did change. It kind of did force everyone to change their lives.
It did.
And
It's going to be a, 20 years from now, it's going to be a really illuminating thing to read the history books of this and that time of COVID and
Yeah.
how it was all handled.
Oh,
And
yeah.
how would you have handled it if you had been in this head of the CDC or World Health or even National Institute of Health? What would you have done? How
It
would
it's
you?
so funny that you asked me this because in my college class, I got asked that question. I'm doing a paper on it right now because COVID is being used as a case study for colleges, right? Because it was, it, I mean, it's in my introduction to professional ethics class. We talk about moral dilemmas, what to do as professionals, the decisions we have to make as state and government leaders between public health, civil liberties. That's the biggest one, public health versus civil liberties. Because we even looked at other case studies in the past of anti-vaxxers and a lot of stuff in California, of course. But, and we always talk about, individual freedom versus, well, It's interesting how humanity has evolved to be this, like, such a community where there's kind of the destruction of individualism. You know, there's this mandatory vaccination policies, you know, because they're like, well, you have to look out for everyone. But in the past, it wasn't look out for everyone. It was look out for yourself. And I think it's interesting how we've become such a community. And I think it's great, but I think we need to make an area where people can be individuals. You know, there's only so much off-gridding available. You know, I'm not saying anarchy, but there should be like make a city of individualism. You know, but as far as like the decisions, I believe that COVID was a biological weapon. I don't believe it was God made, and I can't really speak on his behalf. But I don't think it was nature made. You know, I think it was human engineered. And so the biggest thing for me is finding out who engineered it and why. And maybe I would know that. Maybe I would say, hey, it was me and my people if I was in charge, because that could be the case. It could have been America. It could have been China. I think there was a lot of exaggeration with it. I think there's a lot of
Well, again,
numbers
that's
that are
why it's going to be
falsified.
interesting, your belief there. And that's why, once the fog of war has finally cleared and the historians have a chance to write about it, and in the, in the clear In the clearness of time, we may learn exactly the evolution of
And
the
that's
whole
what
thing.
Steven said on our show. He said, what do you say? He said only the big pharma and big government, they're the only people, and only Pfizer really know what happened. And even then, it's maybe only the highest ups that know what went on with that. As far as vaccinations, I got into arguments with people because I said it's just too soon, and people were trying to say, well, it's proven this and that. I said, look, any new scientific experiment takes years of studying. And for me, it's like, look, when it comes to your body and your health, then you really don't want something experimental going in there if it's not proven. You know, even vaccines that have existed for a while still have stuff that shows up, new developments, because everyone is different. You know, first off, it's hard to make a vaccine that's going to affect everyone the same way. Everyone's biology and DNA, while it's the same on some level, it's completely different. We all have different responses. You know, there's people who got the vaccine and felt fine. There's people who got the vaccine and developed blood clots. There's people who got it and got terrible fever and were paralyzed, you know? And so I think my biggest issue with it was mandatory vaccination. And I was forced to by the military. They basically said, if you don't get it, we're kicking you out. And it was different for every base. My best friend, we talked about him on the last episode. Basically, he was on hold for like a year and a half because he refused to vaccinate. And the military kept changing whether they were immediately separating you, they were putting you on hold, they were going to do this and that, whether it was honorable or not. And so I wish, you know, I really regret getting the one shot that I had to get. I didn't get, was not getting boosters. I think that whole idea was really stupid, to have all these additional shots on top. But, you know, and there's so many conspiracy theories. You know, my grandma believes it was just sugar water. You know, there wasn't an actual shot. So,
Well, I have read,
but I mean,
this is way above my pay grade. And like I said, I'm going to wait for the history books to come out. But I have read recently, something on the mRNA, and it's been in development for a long, long time. And apparently, according to the reading I've done, it's just a matter of the final tweaks to. We may be on the edge of a revolution as far as vaccines go. I don't know. We'll see. There's according to the articles I've read, there's great promise, but we'll see. And I'm just gonna, I'm just gonna wait to see what the history books write.
No,
So.
I'm definitely curious too, just seeing my generation and everyone who lived through COVID 40 years from now, if we all develop something, you know, or if something happens, because we're the case study. I hate to say it, Russ, we're actually the case study for the future. You know, we're the guinea pig, so to speak.
Kind of well, you never know. I mean, that's what's so interesting about moving into the future, see what happens. But
Well,
I don't know.
hopefully.
It's kind of like, you talk about the individual versus the state, the overarching authorities, the religious, or governmental or society. It's the Luke Skywalker story. It's, follow the force, be an individual, Luke, while you're working within this framework. of,
Right.
in Luke's case, the rebel setup, all the fighters and the hierarchy and that. But he, that
Yeah.
was the quest of the individual, and that's the story. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
That's the primary story. I mean, whether we're writing a work of fiction, a novel, or a memoir like mine,
Right.
it's still a story. It's that individual quest.
Yeah, and
What
you can.
is it to be an individual in this
Right.
complex human structure we've
Right.
created?
That's ever changing, always changing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and ladies and gentlemen, check out the first episode of Generational Bridge Builders. We actually discussed, Stephen and I. He had to go out of country. He's a cancer survivor. He was sentenced to die pretty soon, and the cure at the time was experimental. It was not FDA approved, and so the guy who actually saved his life got arrested. And so we got into discussion of the who is the government to tell me what medical procedures I can and not can or cannot get done. Whether it's experimental or not, proven or safe or not, it's my body, my choice. If I want to take this risk to save my life from a cancer inside of me, what right do they have to tell me no? And so we kind
Absolutely.
of debate about that, and Stephen's response was pretty interesting,
Yeah.
and the conclusion is, the government, we appreciate the government, intervening in medical practices when there's negligence and mispractice and stuff like that. But I think, I don't think we should be forced to wait for the FDA or the government to approve, be like, hey, this is okay. Just because I think if it's going in your body and it's not affecting other people, because the Slayer and I had this discussion too. You can't buy cigarettes or alcohol or rent a hotel room till you're like at least 21. And we talked about how other countries have, these younger ages where you can do that. And I said, well, look, why can't I buy cigarettes? Who's that affecting? That's affecting me. So his argument was that, alcohol shouldn't be allowed to be purchased until you're older because it can affect other people's lives. But cigarettes should be purchasable for minors because, hey, you're aware, or you should be made aware before you buy them of what you're putting in your body. But that's your body and that's your choice. But when it comes to drinking, because it can end another person's life because of drinking and driving and stuff like that, that's affecting society, then there should be a restriction on it. But a
I
hotel
guess
room,
it's, yeah.
like, that's most like obviously young men and women do get in trouble with hotel rooms when they're younger. But at the end of the day, that's not affecting other people. But renting a car, not being able to rent a car until you're a certain age, that's going to affect other people because you're driving on the road with other people. So I think it's interesting how, we want society to limit what we can do to each other, but not to ourselves. And the vaccine is kind of both, it kind of falls in
It's
both areas because it primarily affects us, but it's something that could affect other people.
well, it's
But Stephen's
contagious.
view on it was,
The virus is contagious. And so how do you,
yeah.
going back to that question, what would you have done? How would you have handled it if you had been, well, first of all, you and I are not educated to the point
Yeah.
to be of it, but we did some of this type of thing in the airline, of course, much smaller scale. When we
Right.
would have to make a choice about safety, we always tried to err on the most conservative side, the safest way to operate.
Yeah, of course.
We'd do something that, like, 95% of the time, it would be fine if we operated with that threat, but we weren't willing to take that chance. We wanted to be as close to 100% safe as possible.
Okay.
And I've kind of thought about that. If I was in Fauci's shoes, or
Whoever, yeah.
CDC or whatever, what choices would I have made? Would I want to be close to, again, close to 100%, or make choices to preserve people's liberty? Would
Well,
that over,
here's what I think, Russ, because I get what you're saying. Yeah, safety, but I'm gonna gesture to this giant American flag. Don't tread on me behind me. Because here's the thing. Then if you're worried about what's out there, stay home. As simple as that. Don't force everyone to stay home. If I want to take the risk of getting sick and go out to wherever I want to go, that's my choice, right? And I understand that the issue is, well, you may spread it to someone. Well, I'm only spreading it to someone else who is out there willing to take that risk, you know? So I think forcing is it goes into this. I hate the one team, one fight mentality. You know, they preach that in the Navy. I hate that, the one team, one fight. Look, I do think it's one country, one fight, but on some level, look, you can't tell everyone to stay home because one individual or a small group of individuals or a couple of states out of all the states wants, you know, to be cautious. I think, look, if you want to stay home, stay home. All right. There's Amazon Fresh and not a sponsor, but stuff like that would deliver food to your house or whatever, or hunker down. But if I want to go out and go to the movies or mall still, and there's employees who still want to get paid and are willing to take that risk to be at the mall to sell me stuff, then that's that. I wouldn't have restricted everyone's freedom. I would have said, look, if you want to get the vaccine to protect yourself. But here's something interesting that Steven said. He goes, the vaccine, and I don't know if this is true or not, he said, doesn't change your ability to transmit it or not. If you have COVID, vaccinated or not, and you give it to someone else, that's how it works. The vaccine is to protect yourself from getting it, not from giving it to other people. And that's totally true. And
I
there was
guess if you got
plenty
the
of
virus,
people.
yeah, if you have the
Yeah.
virus in your nasal, passages, you're gonna spread it.
Yeah.
I suppose
Doesn't matter
that's
if you're
what it was.
vaccinated or not. In fact, there's plenty of people who were vaccinated and still got terribly sick. People who were vaccinated and passed away. And so I think one, the success rate of the vaccine is not the best. And two, if you can still get COVID when you're vaccinated, you can still transmit COVID when you're vaccinated. And so vaccination isn't the protection of society and others, it's the protection of yourself primarily then. And if the protection of yourself is the primary goal and result of the vaccine, then it is an individual choice, not the government's choice.
Well,
And
this is
that's
a
how I would.
wonderful philosophical discussion on
Oh, thank you.
individual rights versus societal
Yeah.
protections, and it's something that we'll be talking about for decades to come,
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, I know. We're talking about flying airplanes, and next thing you know, it's discussing government versus individual.
Well,
But
it's a lot about
yeah.
how do you keep people safe that are in your charge? You're
Yeah.
placed in charge of others. Safety and well-being, and airplanes obviously is,
Yeah, and I think
two or
if
three
people
hundred
want to
people
take the
sitting.
risk and fly on an airplane during COVID, that's their choice. You know,
Well, they're
if
also putting the people back in the back. Two or 300 people are also putting themselves in your hands. They are assuming that the
right.
people that are operating it are going to protect them, and they don't really have to think about it. They don't have to do for.
And I think
For
that's the
the
wrong
majority of people, I don't
mentality.
think they feel like it's taking a chance because it's been proven over the decades to be a safe, reliable way of
Oh yeah, I'm saying in terms
transportation.
of diseases and COVID. Yeah, obviously, if I'm getting in a plane, I expect the captain to know what he's doing. But when it came to like the COVID, right? I'm not if I get on a plane and I'm not going to expect to not get COVID just because Captain Russell Roberts is flying and he knows what he's doing. He's an airline pilot. That's out of your control. I trust you to what's in your control to handle. And I think, you know, whatever is out of your control, you know, like a virus spreading on your plane, that's out of your control. Just like the water parks where Coxsackie spread and everyone got sick. I mean, at the end of the day, the water park, I don't think it's at fault. If someone snuck in or got past them sick, you know, and sure, maybe the water park should require checking people to get into the water park. But look at it this way. You're going to the water park knowing that you're going to be in a public water system with other people, and there's a chance that diseases will be transmitted. If you go in a pool with children, with it, let's look at it this way. Let's compare COVID to children's urine, so to speak. If you go in a pool with kids, and you're like thinking you had this mindset that there's no piss in the pool at all, that's wrong. And so it's like if you're going to go out when there's a virus and expect, well, everyone's going to have the self-control to, you know, not be sick or go out when they're sick. Look, it's like kids in a pool. They're just going to pee. All right. You know, and if you get into that water system expecting it to be perfectly fine, I mean, you're wrong.
There's two things that occur to me. One is to let Darwinism just
Yeah.
make its course. Don't
Oh,
try to
yeah.
protect anybody from anything, and the survival
Oh,
of the
yeah.
fittest. There's that. There's also our successful fight against smallpox, for example, and through vaccinations
Yeah.
and good health care, we've for all As far as we know, it's been completely eradicated on planet Earth, which has been a, it seems to me that's a benefit. So, and everything in between, so it, like I said, it's a great philosophical discussion. Where are we going to go with this? How are we, and
Well, I'll
I
give you
think
my
that
final
may be.
statement. We have an immune system built into us. We have it for a reason, and I think we should use it and not disregard it. And I think we're making weaker and weaker humans.
Well, there. Well, that worthy of a worthy argument. I mean, yeah, we're you and I are examples. We're here. We're the end product of currently of the the 117 billion people who have ever lived on this planet since people were people, and and everything else that's alive now is a successful. We're it's all here for a reason because of immunities being developed or safety protocols or so it's a great discussion.
Yes, sir. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, that was your if you took away anything from that, I mean, I think that was a huge takeaway, but yeah, here with Captain Russell Roberts, and he has another book coming out. So before that comes out, make sure you read Unlearning to Fly, Navigating the Turbulence and Bliss of Growing Up in the Sky. It's a pretty good book. I enjoyed it. You got to read it. The ending will blow your mind. And Captain, you have anything for us?
Well, M. Mark Whiskey, I appreciate the
Thank you.
opportunity. It was
M&M
a
Whiskey.
really nice discussion, a far-ranging discussion, and it's been a pleasure being with you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And so, ladies and gentlemen, with that, we are. Well, what's the message you say when you land the airplane? Besides, we'll be exiting soon. Is there like a thing you say when you land? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've landed. Or what do you say, Roberts?
After we've landed, usually the flight attendants are the ones to talk. But
Oh, okay.
yeah, it's been nice, nice being with you. Real pleasure. Come travel with us again.
Sailing through the ocean blue, nuclear reactors, my crew, guiding the ship. The stars as our guide, through the waves we ride. Jokes of laughter fill the air. On this voyage, we have to share. Working together, side by side, as one family, we will abide. In the heart of the ship, we reside. Nuclear operators with pride, powering the vessel with every stride. Our mission, a source of great pride.